Of course, today's launch is taking place on the land of the Gadigal people. And to welcome us to Gadigal country, I'd like to ask the chairperson of the Metropolitan Aboriginal Land Council and someone who's quoted in this year's social justice report as being one of the organisers of the Blackout Violence program, I'd like to welcome Rob Welsh and ask him to come and welcome us to Gadigal country.
Thanks, Gary. Once again, my name's Rob Welsh and I'm the chairperson of the Metropolitan Local Aboriginal Land Council. I'd like to begin by acknowledging our Aboriginal elders, both past and present, and welcoming all my Aboriginal brothers and sisters from whatever Aboriginal nation you've travelled. Welcome to Gadigal land. I'd also like to welcome my non-Indigenous brothers and sisters, whether you've travelled across the road, across town, across this beautiful country of ours, or from across the seas. Welcome to Gadigal land, Aboriginal land. The Gadigal people are one of 29 Aboriginal clans that make up the Eora Nation. The Eora Nation's boundaries are the Georges River to the south, the Nepean River to the west, and the Hawkesbury River to the north. Within those mighty rivers is the mighty Eora Nation. I'd just like to finish off with Metro Land Council's slogan, and it goes like this: always was, always will be, Aboriginal land. So once again, a warm and sincere welcome to one and all. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Rob. For some years now, Tom Callamer has been very concerned to provide the results of his reports out to as many people as possible, and he's released a number of community guides. This year, for the first time, those community guides will be supplemented by some short films to give people a better idea of the content of the two reports. So before we hear from Tom, we'll be having a look at the two short films that will be accompanying the two reports. Thanks.
The second report that I do is the Native Title Report. This year's Native Title Report looks back at the 15th anniversary of the High Court's decision in Mabo No. 2, which led to the passage of the Native Title Act 1993. Since it was introduced, the Native Title system has been successfully used in many parts of Australia. However, these successes can hide serious problems. 15 years on, the system is in gridlock, and many Indigenous people feel that it has delivered little in the way of meaningful results. The process, it seems, is seen by many to exacerbate old conflicts and create new ones between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians. In this report, I argue that the Native Title system has become too complex, too lethargic, and too bureaucratic. The changes made to the Native Title system by the previous government seem to have dealt with the imperatives of government rather than the needs and aspirations of Indigenous peoples. The report also considers a number of significant changes that have been made to the Native Title system over the last year. These changes will have a direct impact on Indigenous stakeholders and their representatives. As the changes are implemented, it will be interesting to see whether they improve the system. My initial concerns is that the changes have not focused on ensuring that the system provides for greater recognition and protection of Native Title, and that they will not deliver this. Changes to the Native Title Act have placed a much greater emphasis on resolving claims through mediation by giving powers, and stronger powers, to the Native Title Tribunal and changing the role of the Federal Court. The Tribunal is now the primary mediator of Native Title claims. New powers have also been given to the Federal Court. The court may now dismiss claims that fail the registration test, and in certain circumstances, it may dismiss claims lodged in response to a future act notice. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander representative bodies assist traditional owners to gain protection and recognition of their native title rights, while prescribed bodies corporate hold and manage native title on their behalf. Without these two groups, the whole native title system will grind to a halt. Changes to the Act now allow non-Indigenous corporations to perform the functions of representative Indigenous bodies. Representative bodies are now only recognised for limited, fixed terms of between 1 and 6 years. I'm concerned that such short-term recognition periods may result in an erosion of the independence and security of representative bodies. In addition, if the bodies are not adequately funded, it compromises their ability to provide effective representation. These concerns may be allayed if the government administers the scheme in a transparent, accountable and responsible way. In addition, it is essential that traditional owners and the community are able to participate in important decisions and give informed consent. I would strongly encourage prescribed bodies corporate to continue to ensure that the right people speak for country. The Australian Government funds many elements of the Native Title system, including the Respondent Funding Scheme, which can provide financial assistance to certain non-claimant parties to participate in Native Title proceedings. New guidelines for funding and administering the scheme have been released by the Attorney General's Department, which are an improvement. They restrict who is eligible to receive assistance and provide greater safeguards against misuse of the scheme. However, the restrictions on who may receive assistance under the guidelines may not go far enough. It is important that participants in Native Title proceedings have a real and significant interest in the proceedings. The involvement of parties in Native Title proceedings who have no such interests makes the proceedings unnecessarily complex, lengthy and expensive. The outcomes may also be compromised. Right around the country there are a number of positive initiatives where Indigenous peoples are using their land to pursue economic, social, cultural and environmental outcomes. The 2007 Native Title Report profiles some of these innovative projects. Winner of the 2007 Eureka Prize for Innovative Solutions to Climate Change, the Western Arnhem Land Fire Abatement Project utilises traditional fire burning practices to reduce carbon emissions and generate income for local communities. Indigenous Land Use Agreements, or ILUAs, are an important tool of the Native Title system. They are voluntary agreements that, once finalised, are legally binding on all parties. The Central Queensland ILUA template is the result of 3 years of negotiation. The Gurung Land Council, Aboriginal Corporation, worked with three Native Title claim groups from Central Queensland, the Local Government Association of Queensland and 16 local governments to develop a template for future ILUA negotiations. While a number of ILUAs have been negotiated around Australia to address individual situations, templates for these agreements are a recent development. They include standard clauses, terms and conditions which can then be applied to individual agreements to suit different situations and achieve specific outcomes. The Central Queensland ILUA template would serve as a model for other agreements involving local government, allowing groups to learn and build on the experiences of others. The report also discusses changes to the Corporations Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Act that came into effect on the 1st of July 2007, and it looks at provisions of the Northern Territory intervention relating to compulsory acquisition of Aboriginal land. I encourage you to be involved in my work as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner, and visit our website at humanrights.gov.au, where you can access copies of the 2007 Native Title and Social Justice Report, as well as other reports of previous years. And you can also get a CD version of the report and a community guide that will give you a very brief overview of what's in the reports. I wish you well into 2008 and may your social justice and native title needs be met. Thank you. former the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner at the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission. Every year I publish two reports on the issues affecting Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples in Australia, the Social Justice Report and the Native Title Report. Together the reports deal with the enjoyment of the social, cultural, land and economic rights of Indigenous Australians under legislation and government policy. The latest reports were tabled in the Australian Parliament on Thursday the 20th of March 2008. This year's Social Justice Report exclusively focuses on the issue of family violence. Aboriginal children, wherever they live in Australia, deserve a future in which they can have the same opportunity as other children to thrive, develop and enjoy life. All Australian governments should be committed to ensuring an equal start in life for Indigenous children. Without this, the most vulnerable members of our society are required to overcome great adversity merely to access what others take for granted. It is with this challenge in mind that the 2007 Social Justice Report has analysed the intervention into Aboriginal communities in the Northern Territory. The intervention has revealed a determined commitment across Australian society to address the horrors of family violence and child abuse in Aboriginal communities in the Northern Territory. Accordingly, the intention of the Northern Territory intervention is not challenged in this report. What does come into question is whether the approach adopted to achieving this aim is the most suitable. The particular focus of this report has been whether the intervention measures meet Australia's human rights obligations and therefore ensuring that Aboriginal children and their families are treated with dignity and equality. The starting point for determining the human rights implications of the Northern Territory intervention measures is to recognise that they are intended to address family violence and child abuse in Indigenous communities. The report deals with the inconsistencies between the legislation underpinning the Northern Territory intervention and Australia's human rights obligations. All measures to address family violence and child abuse should themselves respect human rights. It would be outrageous to suggest that it is not possible to achieve this. The Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission maintains that the rationale behind the legislation, that is, to protect children and to build capacity in Aboriginal communities, is one which should be undertaken without the need to resort to discrimination. From a human rights perspective, there are three main concerns with the Northern Territory intervention legislation. These are that the legislation contains a number of provisions which are racially discriminatory because they are inappropriately classified as special measures under the Racial Discrimination Act. In addition, the report identifies specific concerns regarding the inconsistency of the income management regime with the rights to social security, privacy and non-discrimination, and the alcohol management regime with the rights to non-discrimination. It also expresses concerns about the absence of effective participation of Indigenous peoples in decision-making that directly affects us. The Social Justice Report draws attention to 19 examples of successful community-run programs which use a range of approaches to address issues of family violence. These include community education, healing, alcohol management, men's groups, family support and child protection, safe houses, and programs for offenders. They all demonstrate the critical need to confront family violence, but to do so in a way that reinforces the inherent worth and dignity of Indigenous Australians.
And Roland Huntingwell is really engaging with them in the community. Mm. Shop fronts, the drop-in centre.
Resource centre.
The resource centre. And from that platform, we're able to address issues that often by the time they get funded and go as bigger programs, they've changed into something else. I don't know if you really know what I mean, but we can almost immediately address some of the issues. I think in the campaign, Enough is Enough, and that was in response to the sexual abuse and of women, young women in the community, through the years of
being. Had it, and that's how it morphed into Blackout Violence.
Yeah.
There's always a great sense of purpose that we do something, but we didn't know how to do it. It come about largely, particularly Bronwyn and Dixie, my sister, talking about wanting to do something, and then they started by small bits engaging people through conversations, meeting with other women and eventually getting men involved. And we do have a large support from our male community in this area in regards to it. But talking up that business and getting people comfortable first, that was our first step, is engaging people in that dialogue about violence and sexual abuse, because that was a very difficult hurdle. The march down the block, Bronwyn?
Yeah, the rally at the block. The
rally in the block.
Attended by 200-300 people. Mm. A lot of support from Man Chairperson of the local land council spoke there. And really challenged the drug use, abuse and sexual assault and abuse of women. Bertie's, that Sonia brings to you.
So the girls had the idea. It's all their idea. It come from their discussions with men and women. And they wanted to look at developing it into a program, into a format, so they can deliver it as a program and eventually seek funding from government. The first idea wasn't to get money, but to get people involved.
Yes.
And eventually we got a small grant from government to cover, would you believe, the whole of New South Wales, I think something like $20,000 or something. Very minimal to cover whole New South Wales for a whole violence and abuse campaign.
For a year.
For 1 year. That include wages,
materials,
travel,
resources.
And to do the resource material. And they thought they were doing this great thing. The first big legs of the campaign was taking to the New South Wales Aboriginal Knockout. Dixie and another lady turned up at the knockout. They addressed it because they wanted a free stall, because we didn't have the money. The stalls are like $6,000 each. We didn't even have that to rent it.
Yeah.
So we asked for a stall and a space to be able to say that. All the footballers wore the purple armband in recognition of women. And it's gone from this. Every knockout we've had for the last, how many knockouts? About four or five. We've had a booth that donated to us, the knockout committee. And we've had staff here, both paid and unpaid, just person in the store.
Yeah, sure.
And
these case studies provide an opportunity to celebrate their successes and learn from their experiences. They also offer some key lessons we can build on. The importance of community consultation and capacity building, the value of taking a holistic approach to deal with complex issues, and the critical need to involve men and to empower women. I firmly believe that the answers to Indigenous problems can be found in Indigenous communities. Rather than reinventing the wheel every time a new policy or program is announced, tomorrow's national strategy should come out of today's promising practices. My report also identifies a range of options to modify the intervention to ensure that it proceeds in a manner that is consistent with Australia's obligations to protect and promote human rights. I outline a 10-point plan for modifying the Northern Territory intervention so that it respects the human rights of Aboriginal people and treats us with dignity. The overall objective of this action plan is to remove the discriminatory elements from the legislation in its operations while still delivering an effective intervention. So long as Northern Territory intervention legislation permits the conduct of racially discriminatory actions, it will also leave Australia in breach of its international human rights obligations and will lack legitimacy amongst Aboriginal peoples and communities, as well as the broader Australian society. We need to support Australia's Indigenous communities through meaningful consultation, evidence-based policy and long-term commitments. Our children deserve nothing.
If you'd like to get copies of those videos, they're available on the CDs accompanying the community guide for both reports, and I'm told you will also be able to access them via the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity website. That's humanrights.gov.au, and that will take you to YouTube, where you'll be able to access those reports online. And just before we hear from Tom, a reminder that after morning tea, we have Ray Martin chairing a very eminent panel of experts on native title. So we want to encourage you to stay around after morning tea for our native title panel. Just before Easter, the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition signed up to a statement of intent, developing a new partnership with leaders in Aboriginal health and committing to two deadlines to close the life expectancy gap for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people within a generation. That was the culmination of a couple of years of very hard work, largely by our next speaker, Commissioner Tom Calmer. Tom gave the recommendations for closing the gap in his 2005 Social Justice Report. Since then, he has led the Close the Gap Coalition and was able to achieve the recommendations of his report becoming the official policy of both the government and the opposition in this country. Tom is a Kungarkran and Iwija man from the Northern Territory. He is both the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner and the Race Discrimination Commissioner with the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission. He's a former senior diplomat in places like India and Vietnam. He'll be speaking today to launch his social justice report on the issue of protecting Indigenous children. Today's speech is also the fourth of a series of six speeches that Tom will be giving on essentials for social justice, and those speeches will be available in a publication later on this year. So would you join me, please, in welcoming Commissioner Tom Calmer.
Thank you, Gary, and good morning all. Can I also say a warm welcome to my Indigenous brothers and sisters? I know many of you come from outside of Sydney, and welcome here. Also to our friends, our non-Indigenous friends who have come along. I know some have travelled from interstate this morning, and so thank you as well. And also to the media. It's a bit of an overkill seeing me all this morning, and it's the third one, but that was an interesting the DVD because that's just come out. I hadn't seen it prior to now, but I think it needs a bit of work. Anyhow, can I begin by paying my respects to the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, the traditional owners of the land in which we're meeting today, and also pay my respects to their elders and to the ancestors and to those who have come before us. And also thank you to Rob Welsh for your generous welcome. Rob's always very, very welcoming and encouraging for all of us to recognise that this is Gadigal land, and also very welcoming for us to share it with him. Thank you for everybody who's attending the launch of the latest Social Justice and Native Title reports. These reports were tabled in the Federal Parliament on the 20th of March 2008, and the video you've just seen outlines the contents of the report, and so I won't cut across that too much today. This speech focuses on the findings of the Social Justice Report, and the panel debate that follows will focus on the findings of the Native Title Report. This speech is also part of a series of, well, it's six but maybe even seven that I'll be delivering nationally over the coming months, and it'll outline an agenda for change across all areas of Indigenous affairs. And I've termed the series of speeches Essentials for Social Justice. Today's speech is titled Protecting Indigenous Children. No one wants to see children abused, families destroyed, and the aspirations for a bright future dulled because hope has been overwhelmed by despair. Aboriginal children, wherever they live in Australia, deserve a future in which they have the same opportunities as all other children to thrive, develop, and to enjoy life. They are entitled to such a future than that they are human, they are born with dignity and in full equality to all other Australians. Such equality involves being able to live and grow in safety without fear of violence or intimidation, without a thriving, caring and loving family unit and according to our own cultures or the cultures of whoever we are as peoples of Australia. It also involves living in an environment where individuals are able to exercise control over their own lives, where they're able to make decisions, where they are responsible for those decisions and their impacts on their family and the communities in which they live, and where their choices are meaningfully backed up by means to achieve them. This requires access to basic services and the provision of education in order to build dreams and hope, as well as create the personal capacity to achieve these. For many Indigenous children across Australia, such equality is but a pipe dream. For some, overwhelmed by the environments of dysfunction, it is not even dreamed of. It is a tragic fact that an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander child born today does not have the same life chances as other Australian children. All Australian governments should be committed to ensuring an equal start in life for Indigenous children. Without this, the most vulnerable members of our society are left in a position where they must overcome extreme obstacles and differing forms of adversity merely to access what all other Australians take for granted. This is something that should not exist in the 21st century Australia. Addressing it is the defining challenge for our nation, and it's defining not only for the peoples of Australia, but also all governments of Australia. And it is with this challenge in mind that I present to you the Social Justice Report 2007. This year's report considers the most heart-wrenching and difficult issues that can be faced by any community, and that is family violence and child abuse in Indigenous communities. The Social Justice Report approaches this issue from four different perspectives. First, it provides an overview of the statistics and the evidence about the extent and pattern of violence and abuse in Indigenous communities. It includes detailed information about the findings of inquiries into family violence and abuse, and it identifies a continuum of services and responses that are necessary to address all of the factors that ultimately contribute to such high rates of violence and abuse in our communities. Second, it considers efforts by Indigenous communities themselves to combat abuse and violence. It seeks to create, and it also seeks to celebrate, the successes that exist in our communities, for they do exist. And it identifies the significant challenges that communities face in keeping programs going. It also identifies some of the lessons that we can learn from our own people about successfully tackling violence and abuse. And the report does this through 19 case studies covering the program nationally, and we saw that in the CD reference. Third, it provides an overview of current and recent efforts by all Australian governments to address violence and abuse. You'll find in the report a very comprehensive overview of the programs and policies as they exist in every state and territory, at the federal and through COAG, on Indigenous family violence. Finally, the report provides a detailed analysis of the Northern Territory intervention. Barely a day goes by without a chilling and heartbreaking story of abuse, violence or neglect, or of new ideas often born out of frustration in addressing this. Ultimately, the sustained scrutiny and national level debate on issues of violence and abuse creates a momentum for change and for action. Clearly, we need such change. What the report does is to place the needs for change into the context to ensure that the challenge and the change is well considered. It's evidence-based and is capable of being achieved in a systemic and systematic way. I have a major concern about Indigenous policy at the moment, and that is it's developed in an ad hoc manner, where significant new changes are made at very short notice, with limited Indigenous involvement and in response to crisis situations. We risk losing sight of our overall objective when policy develops in this way. If we are genuinely committed to protecting our children, then we must ensure that the actions that we take are soundly based so that they work into the long term. Short-term expedience and undeliverable promises have no place in Indigenous policy generally, but specifically have no place where the safety and the protection of children is involved. As I'll explain shortly, such experiences include overriding human rights protections for Indigenous peoples. This is not some technical matter. It goes to the core of the effectiveness of the processes that are being introduced. What we have seen in recent years is a growing despair and growing sense of urgency from governments to deal with issues relating to child abuse and family violence in Indigenous communities. When you combine this sense of despair and the growing sense of urgency with the determination to do things differently, you can see how something as radical, as intense and as divisive as the Northern Territory intervention emerges as the basis for new policy approaches. Regardless of your views on the appropriateness of the approach adopted in the Northern Territory, and I have a lot to say about this in a moment. The intervention has blown out of the water once and for all the status quo in Indigenous policy making. The status quo is a fallacy that if governments continue on their existing path, eventually the substantial issues facing our Indigenous communities will be resolved, that the violence will be addressed, and that the entrenched poverty will be addressed, and so on. It is a fallacy that governments have to date been doing everything within their power and resources to address. And it is a fallacy that government efforts are sufficiently targeted to achieve their desired outcomes. This fallacy has been perpetuated by successive governments at the federal and the state and the territory level. Through their actions in introducing the Northern Territory intervention, the former federal government has admitted to three key things that should forever change Indigenous affairs. First, that governments were not providing Indigenous peoples with basic services that that the rest of Australia takes for granted. Services such as policing and law and order, health and education services, and adequate infrastructure, to name a few. Second, it admitted that the fact that the scale of investment in our Indigenous communities to date has not been sufficient to enable real change, sustainable, long-term gains that can turn communities and people's lives around. And third, it admitted that the challenge needed is not going to be achieved quickly and will require long-term investments. These admissions in turn reveal how simplistic it is to draw the line under all past efforts as failed and strive for newness. They clearly demonstrate that past approaches didn't work because they never had the chance to work. The NT intervention is therefore emblematic of the challenges that we face more broadly in Indigenous policy. We know that similar problems such as the lack of adequate service delivery by governments, all governments, abject poverty, lack of schooling, and high rates of violence exist in communities outside of the Northern Territory, and particularly in our regional centres and urban environments. So how should we respond to this? Ignore it until we hear revelations in the national media about certain communities or regions, then cobble together some quick responses for that area, such as the approach that's too often done and that's too ad hoc. The NT intervention represents the appeal and the seductive charm of embracing new approaches and breaking from the past. But it also represents the dangers of such change without looking back over your shoulder to consider where you've been, what has worked, and what has been the source of the problems faced to date. And it also represents the danger of unilateral action without recognising the importance of undertaking action in partnership with Indigenous communities. In the intervention, this is reflected in processes that treat Indigenous peoples as passive recipients of policy rather than active agents of change. I'm a firm believer that many of the answers to Indigenous problems can be found in Indigenous communities. This is why it is so crucial to learn from successes as well as challenges, rather than reinventing the wheel every time a new policy or program is announced. I believe that tomorrow's national strategy should come out of today's success stories as we consolidate knowledge and experience. That is a major reason why this year's Social Justice Report seeks to highlight success stories and to show how Indigenous peoples are taking control of these issues in many communities. This offers hope as well as valuable experience and learning to inform better service delivery in the future. It is intended to also restore some confidence and dignity to Indigenous Australians who have suffered from the wholesale negative portrayal of Indigenous society by some politicians and by some media. Accordingly, the 19 case studies in the report aim to encourage individuals in communities by showing what can be achieved, to inspire service providers to think critically about how effectively they are delivering their services, and to challenge governments to be responsive and flexible to innovative programs and responses to family violence and abuse. And I'd urge you all to take some time to read about some of the initiatives included in the report. They cover a vast range of different approaches, ranging from community education and development initiatives to healing services, alcohol management, safe houses and family violence perpetrator programs, to initiatives aimed at building the self-esteem of men and creating support structures for men, through to innovative processes for the interface with the care and protection system and supporting women in raising their children. I would urge you to read about Shane. Now, Shane, whose life has turned around since he began attending the Yuri Burko Men's Group in Adelaide, or Dave and his experiences in the Spirited Men's Program at Murray Bridge, or Liz, a young woman whose child, who was considered to be in the at-risk category by child protection, but who has been able to support, with the support of the Strong Young Mums Program in Bourke, to succeed, as well as the other personal stories contained in the report. When you read the report, you'll see that I identify a range of success factors and lessons from each of the case studies. Some of the most significant included in these programs are, firstly, community generated. The most successful programs are those that are developed by the community and that respond to individual community needs. Second, created with genuine community engagement. And this engagement involves more than just consultation. Communities need to have real power to make decisions and have input into program development and implementation. And this can take time and requires flexibility and patience, but ultimately it reaps long-term rewards. Third, it recognises the need for community development. Community development and capacity development, or capacity building, often needs to take place before communities are able to take ownership of family violence initiatives. Fourth, be built on partnership. All of the successful cases were built on partnerships, be it with government departments or with other agencies, including the NGO sector. Fifth, adopt a holistic approach. The underlying situational and precipitating factors of violence and abuse all need to be tackled, and often simultaneously. So while a person participating in a healing program might present with issues around alcohol or drug use, a whole range of practical, cultural, psychological and emotional needs might need to be dealt with as well. And there are many other lessons included in the report. In brief, these include recognising the importance of tailoring projects so that they are culturally appropriate, ensuring a strong connection to culture and respect for traditional law to reinforce anti-violent messages and build positive community identity, recognising the importance of family and utilising extended family ties in developing solutions, including child safety, involving men in the solution to family violence while at the same time empowering women, building on existing community strengths and recognising the important role of Indigenous staff in building legitimacy with the communities and in challenging violent behaviour. The case studies also strongly show that community education, particularly around human rights, needs to be part of a strategic approach to addressing family violence and abuse in order to assist communities to grow and develop capacity, and ultimately creating safer environments for women and children. Although none of these lessons are necessarily new, taken together they provide a framework for developing good family violence interventions. And that leads me back to the NT intervention. If we consider the measures introduced in the Northern Territory, there is a disturbing lack of connection between the actions under the intervention and these success factors that I've just described. Now, I note the intervention. I note that the intention of the intervention process is in several stages, from an emergency intervention to stabilise communities through to a long-term development process. Some of the critical steps in this include the conduct of surveys of needs in communities that are under the intervention, along with child health checks in all of those communities. So there remains potential for some of the early actions already undertaken as part of the intervention to form the basis for modifying the intervention's approach so that it may take these lessons into account over time. Ultimately, the analysis of the social justice report on the intervention focused on whether the legislative basis for the intervention is consistent with Australia's human rights obligations. I argue that measures that violate the human rights of the intended beneficiaries are more likely to work in ways that undermine the overall well-being of the communities in which they live in both the short and the longer term. For example, the government has clearly stated that the anti-intervention seeks to address the breakdown in law and order in Aboriginal communities. And yet it potentially involves introducing measures that undermine the rule of law and that do not guarantee Aboriginal citizens equal treatment to other Australians. If this is the case, then it places a fundamental contradiction at the heart of the anti-intervention measures. This will inhibit the building of relationships, partnerships and trust between governments and the Indigenous communities. It would also undermine the credibility of the measures and ultimately threaten the sustainability and long-term impact of the measures. This is a type of short-term experience that I've spoken of earlier. My starting point for determining the human rights implications of the anti-intervention measures is to recognise that they are intended to address family violence and child abuse in Indigenous communities. It is essential that governments undertake action to address violence and abuse, particularly when there is compelling evidence that it is widespread. Governments that fail to act in these circumstances would be in breach of their human rights obligations. But ultimately, the report has raised significant concerns about the consistency of the legislation underpinning the anti-intervention with Australia's human rights obligations. Human rights law clearly is clear that any measure must be non-discriminatory in their application and impact. This obligation is non-negotiable and unable to be deviated from. Put simply, all measures to address family violence and child abuse should themselves respect human rights. It would be outrageous to suggest that it is not possible to achieve this. The main concerns identified about the anti-intervention legislation from a human rights perspective are as follows. First, the anti-legislation is inappropriately classified as a special measure. It is not possible to support the government's contention that all the measures contained in the anti-intervention legislation can be justified as special measures. It is therefore also not possible to say that that in its current form, the legislation is consistent with the Racial Discrimination Act. There are two concerns in this regard when seeking to clarify restrictive measures as beneficial to the community. You need to demonstrate that consultation has occurred and community consent has been sought for such measures. There is then a second requirement that measures must be appropriate and adapted to the end of meeting child protection. The scope of income management provisions, such as the quarantining of 100% of welfare in some circumstances and its applications to everybody regardless of circumstances, may also not be appropriate and adapted response. This limits the ability of these measures to be legitimately characterised as special measures under the Racial Discrimination Act. Secondly, the anti-intervention legislation contains a number of provisions that are racially discriminating. There are also a number of provisions in the legislation that deny Aboriginal people in the Northern Territory democratic safeguards and human rights protections that exist for all other Territorians and all other Australians. Examples include the lack of merit review of decisions, removal of access to schemes for just terms compensation, exemptions from the application of all laws that deal with discrimination at the federal and territory level, and the removal of requirements to obtain consent for management or control of Indigenous property. These provisions deny Aboriginal people in the Northern Territory procedural fairness and access to justice. And third, the anti-intervention removes protections against discrimination that occurs in the implementation of the intervention measures. Immunity is provided for any act of discrimination that occurs under the provisions of the legislation. This includes a decision made by a bureaucrat or other agent of the government, such as store owners, in all 73 prescribed communities. And this provides an extraordinary broad exemption from the protections of discrimination. The report additionally identifies a range of specific concerns about the consistency of the income management regime with the right to social security, privacy and non-discrimination, and the alcohol management regime with the right to non-discrimination. It also expresses concerns about the absence of effective participation of Indigenous peoples in the decision-making process, and particularly decisions that affect them. What I want to see is change to the current model of the intervention so that it is consistent with human rights and it draws on the strength of the communities so that they are part of the solution and not just treated as if they were the problem. And so the report sets out a 10-point plan for modifying the intervention legislation and the intervention generally. The simple objective of this action plan is to remove the discrimination from the legislation and in its operation. The first 5 points of the action plan are on screen before you, hopefully. Yep, they are. Yeah. They identify changes to the current framework for the intervention to ensure that the legislation is applied fairly with the ordinary protections that apply to all other Australians. For these measures, I challenge anybody to explain how providing these basic democratic protections could possibly hinder the goal of protecting children. The only possible answer is short-term expedience prevailing over guarantees of access to justice, and that's just not good enough. Action 6 and 7 then seek to address the arbitrariness of the existing regime for income management and alcohol restrictions provided for under the intervention legislation. The report states that some form of quarantining and some form of alcohol restrictions can be justified consistently with human rights. The sweeping and discriminatory approach adopted through the legislation, however, is not that approach. The report recommends that the government seeks to implement voluntary community-based schemes in place of the blanket bans that currently exist in the 73 prescribed communities. I expect that there will be a number of circumstances where excellent alternative processes can emerge that are more effective and owned by the communities involved. As an example, the report notes that there were alcohol management plans in place prior to the intervention in all but one of the communities under the legislation. The case study of the Umbercumba community shows how the voluntary scheme has been developed, and it is a very highly successful alcohol management plan. And it's actually beyond the plan, it's actually an implemented scheme. Action points 8 and 9 and 10 then look at how the intervention can transition back to a process that is in partnership with Indigenous communities and where the ambitions are shared rather than imposed. Now, what I'm challenging the government to do is through this action plan is to set out a timetable and a time frame for transitioning the emergency intervention from a stabilisation phase to a community development phase. I propose this occurs through a new mechanism, and it's a mechanism that I've labelled community partnership agreements. By utilising the existing community survey information that is supposed to have been completed in all the 73 communities, as well as building on the lessons learnt through the Indigenous Coordination Centres network that exist across the territory, I expect that the government now has a very clear view of what is needed to occur in each of the communities. But I must say that I went to two of the communities in Darwin last week, in both Bagot and Cullaluck, and neither of them had the survey undertaken there as yet. So it doesn't appear that all have now had the survey done. So if it doesn't, then it has failed to do what it is said to do when the intervention was introduced. A community partnership agreement provides a way of formalising a relationship and agreed vision between the community and the Government of Australia and of the Government of the Northern Territory as to what will happen in any of those communities. It will create hope and ambition that the specific needs of the community will be addressed. And to be frank, there are strong incentives for communities to come on board with such an approach. Such an agreement would provide the basis for the introduction of community-based and supported mechanisms to deal with the issues of child protection, family violence, alcohol and related community development needs. Responsibilities would be truly shared rather than imposed. Having developed this community plan, the Minister for Indigenous Affairs could then declare at some later point, using her powers under the Act, that more appropriate arrangements are in place in a particular community and therefore there is no longer a need for that community to be subjected to the generic arrangements as set out in the intervention legislation. The approach that I'm recommending here is sets out the major challenge to government and to communities. It is also, however, a case of challenging the government to deliver what it has promised to do through the intervention. And it would enable the government to do this in a manner that respects human rights and human dignity. A final comment on this action plan. It strongly endorses the call for an independent review after 12 months of the intervention. An independent review should take place to ensure that the goals of the legislation are being achieved in a manner that is consistent with human rights and allows for any negative consequences to be identified and addressed as soon as possible. Fundamental to the success of such a review will be the involvement and input of Aboriginal people from the communities involved. Ongoing participation from individuals on the ground will not only ensure the legitimacy of the measures undertaken, it will also help to contribute to their ongoing success as the needs and aspirations of the community do change over time. Finally, less than a fortnight ago, I co-convened the National Indigenous Health Equality Summit that Gary mentioned in Canberra. In a historical event on Thursday the 20th of March, the Australian Government entered into a new partnership within the Indigenous health sector to close the gap on Indigenous life expectancy. I want to close by recalling some of the commitments that the Prime Minister and the Minister for Indigenous Affairs signed in this historic statement of intent in closing the gap. The statement of intent, that's what it's called, commits to develop a comprehensive long-term plan of action that is targeted to need, evidence-based and capable of addressing the existing inequalities in health services in order to achieve equality of health status and life expectancy between Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and non-Indigenous Australians by 2030. To ensure the full participation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and their representative bodies in all aspects of addressing their health needs. To build on the evidence-based and supporting what works. To respect and promote the rights of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples and to ensure, to measure, monitor and report on our joint efforts in accordance with the benchmarks and targets to ensure that they are progressively realising our shared ambitions. These ambitions should equally apply in making the anti-intervention a joint effort to maximise the benefits of this unprecedented opportunity and to ensure that our children are indeed safe and protected. The Social Justice Report provides a pathway to achieving this on the basis of mutual respect, partnership and good faith, and I commend it to you. And always remember that from self-respect comes dignity, and from dignity comes hope. Thank you.